Welcome to Home Fires.
I'm John Adams, sitting in for Patty Costello, and I'm very pleased to have as my special guest today Margaret Murie, a well-known writer, wilderness advocate, and Alaskan pioneer. And also, well, this is another pillar of the Alaskan conservation community, Celia Hunter. Good morning to you both, and welcome home, Marty.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, John.
Good morning, John.
It's nice to be back.
Well, you
It's a pleasure to be here with Marty.
Well, you two go back quite a ways, don't you? You've been friends for probably longer than many of our listeners have been around.
Well,
can you remember what year it was?
It was, I think, sometime in the 50s. I'm not sure.
Well, it was quite a while before 56.
Yes.
Because that's when we made our first expedition up into the Brooks Range.
Well, one thing, we may have met through Aide and Louise when they were in
that's
McKinley
how we
Park.
Met, yes.
And you came up with them to visit them, and we had Captain Ollie.
No,
that's
no.
Right.
Who were these people?
My half-sister, Louise, was married to my husband, Olus's half-brother, Adolf Murie.
Mm-hmm. Adolf Murie.
Adolf Murie, who was in the Park Service and made his well-known studies on the wolves of Mount McKinley and the grizzlies of Mount McKinley and the birds and the mammals of Mount McKinley. All of those are published things. The men were half-brothers. They married half-sisters. They were both biologists. They both worked some in Wyoming and a great deal in Alaska, all very confusing. And so we always had to explain how... Anyway, one of those very first trips, I think perhaps Olus may have met Celia and her partner Ginny Wood and Morton Wood before I met them.
We could have met at wilderness conferences.
That's right.
But... Celia, you and Ginny were running Camp Denali at that time.
Right.
And
yes.
Marty, you and your husband and his half-brother and clan
The half-brother was studying the wildlife in what was then Mount McKinley National Park. And my husband was, at that time, had become director of the Wilderness Society. But before that, he was a government biologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service and had made studies of the life history of the caribou of Alaska and Yukon. And a biological survey of the Aleutian Islands and waterfowl work in Hooper Bay and various things.
Boy,
that
we got around. Which yes. Wasn't so easy in those days, I guess.
Well, the government, there was still so much untapped territory at that time. Many wildlife issues that needed study and needed study in depth. And he made the expedition to Hooper Bay in March of 1924 and came out of there in August, and we were married at Little Episcopal Church at Anvik on the Yukon. And the studies went on.
Well, you've written a little bit about that, haven't you?
Yes.
I seem to recall a book or two.
My husband and I were in the office of Angus Cameron, who was senior editor at Alfred Knopf. Olus was just talking to Angus about some conservation question that he was interested in, but before we got out of his office, he had decided I should write a book. And I still have that whole file of letters, 24 letters that Angus Cameron wrote to me, sort of pulling the book out of me. And that's how Two in the Far North came to be.
Well, we're all very glad that he persevered.
He's a great fellow.
It's a marvelous book. One of the books that in my personal experience, I read very early on, actually before I came to Alaska. And
that's nice to know.
It was a wonderful experience. I've read it again since, and as I visited those places on my own, you know, it's helped.
I can't think of any better book for getting the ambience of early day Fairbanks than Two in the Far North, when Marty's writing about being a young girl and growing up in Fairbanks, and that was back in the teens, wasn't it, Marty?
Yes, I was 9 years old when we came to Fairbanks. 1911.
Boy. So you've seen Fairbanks?
I've seen Fairbanks that most Fairbanksans don't know about.
She's a little amazed.
That's what
I'm
talking about tomorrow.
I can imagine.
Trying to find out where am I? Are we on College Road or where it happened to university?
Well,
it's been an interesting day.
Fairbanks was founded when?
1902.
Yeah, yes. So you were here pretty much at the beginning.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you two have a friendship that goes back to the early 50s.
Early 50s.
Mm-hmm. It's also been a working relationship, yes. You've both been involved in the Wilderness Society.
Well, these folks started the Alaska Conservation Society, Celia, Jenny, and
Bob Whedon.
Woody, Bob Whedon, and
Fred Dean,
and a few others.
Yeah.
And Olis and Adolph were both very much interested in that, of course. Mm-hmm. I suppose they did some words of encouragement,
didn't
they?
We started it because of you and Olis. Remember, you came up and went up to the Shinjek, to Lost Lake and Lobo Lake, and spent the summer up there. And
yeah, that was 1956.
Right. And when you came back through here, you were really enthusiastic about what you had seen up there and wanted even more to have that preserved.
Yes.
And I think it was about that time that Olis drew some lines on a map and said, this is sort of the area that ought to be included. And that was what eventually went into the bill in Congress, wasn't it?
Yes. That's right.
Included
in the now boundaries
of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which was started out as the Arctic National Wildlife Range.
Mm-hmm.
But there are four other people that I feel should be mentioned in talking about the Arctic Refuge, and that's Sir Frank Fraser Darling and
Lowell Sumner.
And Lowell Sumner.
George Collins.
And Starker Leopold.
Mm-hmm.
They were all in parts of that territory, the northeast corner of Alaska, traveling around. The Park Service was putting on some kind of a survey trip, really looking around a little bit at that time as to what might be possible, more parks and such.
Mm-hmm.
And George Collins and Lowell Sumner were both in the Park Service, but They all recommended that northeast corner of Alaska be given some special attention of some kind.
At that time.
And that's what got my husband interested. And dear Joe Flackney, who was also a graduate of the University of Alaska in its very early days and was then secretary of the Arctic Institute, said to Olis, my husband was by that time director of the Wilderness Society. We were back in Washington, D.C., and Olis came into the office one day and said, I've just been talking Joe Flackney. He said, if you fellas are beginning to think about wilderness, you better begin to think about it pretty soon in Alaska.
And that was in the 40s.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's right.
At that time, there were very few parks or refuges or
there
monuments.
There was Mount McKinley. There was
Katmai. And Glacier Bay.
Glacier Bay,
was,
sort of, as a monument.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know about the Sitka thing. I don't
know
whether
that's Park.
Yes. That's just a modern, that was a little historical
yes.
park.
Yeah.
And it seems to me there were a few wildlife refuges, but mostly birds.
That's
they
right.
Were mostly preserving bird
habitat. Yeah, there was an Aleutian Wildlife Refuge at that time, and there was one.
I think in the Hooper Bay area.
In the Hooper Bay area, yes.
And a lot of little islands.
Yes.
Remember down St. Lys area and some of those in southeast were wildlife refuges.
But of course, at the time that you're talking about, the Wilderness Act hadn't even passed yet.
Oh, no. No, so we were in the middle of the battle for
that. Wilderness areas, per se, designated wilderness areas.
No, there were only some of those, what they called U2 areas under a regulation of the Forest Service where they did set aside some primitive areas, but no, not real wilderness areas at that time.
When we're celebrating an anniversary here, aren't we?
25th anniversary of the designation of the Arctic National Wildlife Range, as it was called, and by Secretary of the Interior Fred Seaton. I remember that Olis was back in Washington, and he had slides, pictures from our 1956 summer on the Shinjek, and it was arranged for him to show them to Secretary Seaton and some of his staff and some other conservation people and government people back there in Washington. And I remember Joe Penfold, who was then with the Isaac Walton League, said he thought there was somebody sabotaging because Olis was trying to give the slideshow and something went wrong with the slide projector every other minute or so. And Olis would have to keep on talking, trying to think of something to say that Secretary Seaton would consider important to say while the projectionist was struggling with the projector.
Well, apparently,
something
was successful.
Worked. Something worked. I think that was the happiest day of his whole life. In fact, it was one of two, I think only twice I ever saw my husband in tears, and that was one of them. When we had no telephone at Moose in Jackson Hole, where we then lived, and the post office was a mile away. But Jim and Catherine Lake had sent a telegram from Fairbanks. That's the word we got. that Secretary Seton had signed this declaration. Uh-huh. And I had skied out to get the mail, and I came back, and I came in the front door and said, "Oh, there's good news today."
Boy. Well, how do you feel about what's going on now with the management of the Arctic Refuge in particular and any other refuges or parks around the
state?
Well,
I think you had one of the finest and most sensitive managers of a refuge that could possibly be imagined in Ave Thayer. I'm just not acquainted with the newer man. I hope to get to meet him. But I think I feel fine about it, except for the perhaps threat of offshore oil drilling in the Beaufort Sea. Mm-hmm. I don't think that belongs up there. Seems to me the great United States of America is wealthy enough without that little segment being tampered with.
Well, it's not only that, Marty. You know, they are exploring on they're doing seismic explorations on the Arctic coastal plain now.
Yes.
And if they find oil there, they are going to want to develop it. And that's right in the caribou calving grounds and so on.
In the refuge itself.
Within the refuge.
That's within the refuge.
Right. Not offshore, but right within the refuge.
What do we have in the way of protection against that?
I don't know.
Yes.
It's a very serious situation.
Well, apparently, and Celia, you're much more familiar with the details of the Alaska Lands Act than I am, but my understanding is that there was a provision in the Act which allowed for this exploration to go on, and it is, in fact, going on now. I think this must be the second
season. Yes, well, they're supposed to make their 1002 report,
yes.
which is
a Fish and Wildlife Service report on the impacts of seismic exploration on the Arctic coastal plain, and that's supposed to go to Congress, and also, I guess, then the oil companies will make a report on what they found, and then Congress is going to decide what to do about
whether they go on or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sounds a little bit
precarious.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a discovery, then there would have to be an act of Congress to enable the actual development.
Right.
Yes.
Congress did reserve that right to itself.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
The other thing that we're really worried about is the fact that the Fish and Wildlife Service has 16 appraisers in Alaska right now appraising private inholdings all through the refuge system. And there is a suspicion that what may happen as a result of that is that they might take all of the other inholdings and exchange them for giving some of the regional corporations subsurface rights on the Arctic coastal plain. And that is not the will of Congress, and that is something that the conservationists will go into court, I'm sure, to prevent.
I'm sure.
Well, we've kind of backed into this topic, but there's another anniversary this month, December. It's the fifth year anniversary already of the passage of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
That's yes, right. That's true.
Do either of you have any thoughts, any reflection 5 years afterwards? You were both very, very much involved in the congressional battle over the then-called D2 bill. What do you think 5 years later? What do you think the impacts have been? How do you feel about the legislation?
Did you feel there were some compromises in the act?
Oh, verily. I think that there were a lot of compromises in the final
it
act.
It seemed
that
to
was
be
passed.
All we could do at the time.
Well, it was
with any assurance of getting it through.
That's right, because the administration had changed even as it was being passed. So, and of course, the implementation of it has really been very, very deficient.
Yes.
Because they have used it in many instances as a development act instead of a preservation act. And what they're trying to do is to open up areas to a lot of incompatible uses rather than to keep them in their natural state and to maintain the natural aspects of it. And particularly, I think this is true in the way the national parks, they have attempted to, you know, permit airplane landings and ATV travel and that sort of thing within the older park areas. That's the old Mount McKinley
yeah.
National Park and Katmai, where they had never had that kind of travel or use before.
By older,
so
you mean those parks
that were established
before the act?
There were additions. You see, the additions to those areas had different rules than the former parks. The refuges had a clause in the ANILCA, Alaska yes. Native National yeah. Interest Lands Conservation Act, that said that all of the regulations that were in effect on December 2nd, 1980, would continue to be in effect. So those all of the regulations that were protecting the refuges are still in place.
They're still there, but
they did not put
anything.
A clause like that in for the national parks, and it is causing a great deal mm-hmm. of difficulty at the moment.
Yes.
We've been hearing news stories over the last several days about public comment on plans mm-hmm. for management of some of the national interest lands. Can either
well,
one of
some
you
of the national parks
what that is about?
Well, they're putting out their 5-year plan, aren't they?
Well, so yes, they were supposed to have a management plans for each of the national park
yes.
areas by this time, mm-hmm. and because there's been so much protest from development interests, particularly, they have delayed publishing the plans. They're not going to be coming out finally until next spring, and this gives more time for comments and so on. But one of the things that's happening that's really distressing is that in Gates of the Arctic, which should be the premier wilderness park,
oh, that should be the crown jewel, the whole system.
They are trying to authorize ATV use throughout the park in connection with subsistence hunting. And, of course, subsistence hunting has not taken place in many areas of that park traditionally.
No.
So there's no excuse for opening it up that way.
Marty, I take it you were in the Gates of the Arctic Park long before there was even a concept of Gates of the Arctic
Well, I had
Park.
A dog team honeymoon in what's now Gates of the Arctic National Park.
Could you tell us a little bit about your honeymoon?
I guess the strangest
thing... It's not
thing...
too personal a question. But since you've written a book
well,
about
yes,
it,
I... Well, that's why Angus Cameron had to pull kind of hard to get all that out of me. Anyway... I guess the first unusual thing was that we were married at 3 o'clock in the morning because that's the time the steamer Jacobs got to Anvik and could stop for an hour so everybody could go ashore while Dr. Chapman married us. And the next thing was that we then got put on shore at 5 o'clock on a rainy morning in Nulato, and we stayed there for 10 days in a little cabin, and then we went up the Koyukuk River in the marvelous little stern-wheel steamer Teddy H and got... by various means as far as Bettles, and then waited till freeze-up, and the dogs had been shipped up earlier, so we went by dog team on up to Wiseman and beyond Wiseman up the Dietrich River, right where the pipeline comes across, uh-huh. I guess, now. And Olus was collecting caribou specimens and data on caribou. He was still on the caribou study at that time. Then we came all the way back to Nenana by dog team from the head of the Koyukuk River. I don't know, something like 550 miles, or perhaps.
Cross country, too.
Oh, yeah, cross country, yes, with the tussocks that didn't have enough snow over them or between them, and the sled was tipping over half all the time.
Well, I love your...
Various things happened, but we got to Nenana.
Your reference to various means of travel, I can imagine. So have you been back up there recently?
Yes, I was back up there in 1975. I had a marvelous time up here, supposedly sort of a consultant to the Park Service, to look at some of the areas that were being studied then for inclusion in the Alaskan mm-hmm. Lands Act, areas that I had not known before. I thought I knew quite a bit about Alaska by that time, but I found out in summer of 75 there was a great deal I hadn't known about. And I went to various areas up to... the Kobuk River, and over into Lake Clark country, mm-hmm. and Talkeetna, and part of the Wrangell-St. Elias, and it was marvelous. And that was under the Park Service. Well, the Gates of the Ark, yes, from Bettles.
Well, I think the most interesting thing, we went back to Old Bettles, didn't we?
Oh, yes.
Old Bettles.
Oh, the Bettles that we knew in 1924 is almost all washed into the river by this time. There were still two or three buildings left, one of them the cabin that Olus and I had lived in for a month.
Wow.
And Gary Everhart, the director, then director of the National Park Service, was with us, and Ted Swam, one of his assistants, who had a great deal to do with the studies of these areas, Celia Hunter, Bob Bellis of the Park Service, and John Musser, with Rhoda, his wife, took us down from New Bettles one evening.
But you know Rhoda Bettles. Long ago.
Yes, when she was a little girl. And she remembered. She remembered. She was 10 years old when Olus and I were trying to get up the Keokuk River on the last falling water. Teddy H. was having a hard time. Yes, but that's part of the book. But it was marvelous to meet Rhoda again after all those years. We both cried. But she remembered so well. Yes, well, the little cabin we lived in was still there. It may have slid into the river by this time.
Could be.
There are
We went out to Walker Lake also.
Yes, and then, yes, and we flew to Walker Lake. And Celia and I flew with Ave Thayer in the Beaver airplane. And Gary Everhart and all the rest of the party were out there. That was a nice camping place for 2 days. And a lot of discussion about what these areas should be, how large an area they should be, all the reasons why they should be protected in some way. A marvelous part of the world up there.
It sure is.
And, of course, the Sheenjack Valley is a place that's just dearest to my heart of anything, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's where we spent the summer of 56 with Bryna Kessel, who's now at the university. And George Schaller, who was an internationally known biologist.
Indeed.
Giant pandas, jaguars, what else?
Snow leopards.
And snow, yes. And the Serengeti lions. And Dr. Bob Creer from the University of Colorado, who was also with us and is now living in Estes Park, Colorado, and comes to stay with me quite often at Moose. It was one of those ideal summers when everything clicked and everything went harmoniously and everybody was happy and everybody was just sorry that the days went by so fast. It was a great experience. And then we went back again in 61, and we had two 15-year-old boys from Washington, D.C. with us that time. And that was fine, too. The weather wasn't quite as good as it. We really, 56 was an ideal summer.
Well, we haven't had an ideal summer in the last several.
No.
I've been up there myself, and it seems like it's you know, they always talk about it being a semi-desert.
Oh, my.
Find it hard to believe.
Well, the summer of 75, when we were traveling around these two that we were just talking about, that was pretty nice weather.
That was
all
nice
the time.
Weather.
Yes.
Right.
Well, you mentioned...
So Celia and I have shared a good many kinds of experiences.
Yes, that one, 1975, was the year that we survived the plane wreck up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
I remember you writing about that, but why don't you relate that little vignette?
You tell about it, Celia. You know what was going on. I was just thinking, well, that engine sounds awfully funny. Even I thought it was sounding funny.
Well, we were in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge with Dave Spencer in one beaver and Ave Thayer in another beaver. And the Fish and Wildlife Service had invited Bryna Kessel and Marty and myself to have a look at some of the new additions to the refuge that were being planned, the Marsh Fork.
Yes, and that is a part of it now.
Yes, it is.
The Marsh Fork of the Canning River.
Right. That was one of the places that we were supposed to look at. But to begin with, we went from here to Fort Yukon and waited there until Dave Spencer joined us. Then we took two airplanes up and landed on a lake, not Lobo Lake or Lost Lake, but quite close up in the Sheenjack and stayed overnight.
Yeah, Sheenjack Lake.
Was it Sheenjack Lake?
That's what they call it.
And then we went on over the Brooks Range to Peters Lake and stayed over there overnight. And meantime, I guess we went up to Barter Island and picked up some gasoline
did.
And came back and parked it on the lake. And we were headed for the Marsh Fork the next morning. And Bryna was riding with Dave Spencer, and they got off the lake very quickly. And Ave took Marty and myself. Marty was in the back seat, and I was riding co-pilot with Ave. We started off on it a little later, and as soon as Dave and Bryna saw that we had cleared the water, why, they turned away and headed for the Marsh Fork. Well, we followed them, but we crossed the Saddler Ochet River, and we were headed down Eagle Creek, I think is the name of this little narrow canyon.
It was
narrow, very precipitous sides. And Marty and I were sitting there oohing and aahing over all the mountain sheep that were just right off the wingtip, you know. And all of a sudden, the airplane started making the most gosh-awful clatter. And I looked at Ave, and he looked at me, and he suddenly wheeled around, and we headed back into the big, broad valley of the Saddler Ochet because there was no place to go straight ahead except into a narrow box canyon. So he was fiddling with everything, trying to get the engine to stay running. He was hoping he could get us back to Peters Lake to land. But it was not holding its own. We were losing altitude all the time, and there was one little tiny pocket lake up the head. And Abe looked at it and he said, what do you think? And I said, it's awful short. And he said, I think so too. And so there was nothing for it. We were on floats and we had nothing except gravel to land on beside the Saddler Rochet River. There was a good stiff wind blowing about 20 knots from the south. So he was nursing it down and nursing it down, and I was sitting there. He told turned around and told Marty to get a sleeping bag and put it up in front of her face, and so Marty did, but she kept peeking around the corner of to be sure that she wanted to know what was going on. And I kept looking out down at the float and mm-hmm. at the ground coming up to meet us and wondering what was going to happen when the two connected. And Abe really had us slowed down by the time we hit, but we went clattering and banging along over the rocks.
Three bangs.
And all of a sudden, I could feel the tail beginning to lighten, and I thought, oh, boy, this is it. We're going over. And just then, the right back strut broke, and instead of going up, the tail settled, and we slewed around and stopped. And Abe was out of that airplane in a flash. He ran around it, opened the back door, grabbed Marty out. And I was fumbling. I was still fumbling with my seatbelt, trying to get out myself. And we finally got out and ran up the slope and stood and looked at the airplane. And it didn't burst into flame or anything. So Abe said, "Well, we got to get the emergency gear out." So he said, "Marty, you stay in here and see you come down. I'll throw it to you." And so we started shoveling all this gear out. And the next thing I knew, Marty was right at my shoulder, and here she was taking it out just as fast as I was.
Well, I was insulted. He said, "You go stand over there and see if you'll help me unload the plane." And I thought, what's the matter with me? I'm still able-bodied.
She certainly was.
I guess so.
Well, we
had a wonderful time.
We had a wonderful time there. We got our tents.
Two tents. We had everything. And we even had beautiful holy bread from June Thayer.
That's right.
Well, just an unexpected stop.
There is something affects you somehow, though. I felt no fear. I just felt curiosity. But with all three of us, we couldn't eat or drink anything for about 8 hours, I guess.
Afterwards.
Celia would say, "Shall I start the Coleman? Shall I make some cocoa?" I think about 4 o'clock, she did make cocoa and take it down to Abe, who was still struggling with the radio in the.
Yeah, he was sitting down there coping. The trouble is that with these modern, you've got your locator beacon, but it's VHF, and it just goes up in a cone. Any mountain deflects it upward. And so unless a plane directly overhead, they wouldn't hear it. And so we had to wait until midnight that night before a plane went directly overhead and picked up the...
But by that time, they'd had a message from Dave Spencer that...
That we were missing.
Maybe they'd been looking for you. It was the Army Rescue. And yeah, he said from 12,500 feet with a naked eye, he saw the disaster cloth. That was the first thing that Dave put out on. Mm-hmm. You remember? We spread that thing out and weighted it with rocks.
Yep.
And then the pilot in the Army plane said he was radioing to Prudhoe Bay and in the meantime,
Dead Horse.
He's in Dead Horse. He said, "There'll be a helicopter in about an hour and a half to pick you up." And Celia said, "Well, they know we're all right. Why can't they wait till 8 o'clock in the morning?" She was sleepy. She was asleep when I heard this plane.
You wanted to get your beauty rest.
Yeah, I couldn't see any point in getting rescued. There was nothing a Dead Horse.
Well,
anyway.
Well, it makes a great story, but I'm not sure it was quite as much fun as it sounds.
Oh, well, it was a little harrowing while it was going on.
Well, my only complaint was that Celia, at one point, we were sitting in the tent and mosquitoes were terrible there, worse than anywhere we'd been on that trip. And we were trying to make notes or read something, and she said, "Oh, shipwrecked and not even a deck of cards." And I said, "That's what you think. You look in the side pocket of my pack, and there's two decks of cards. I don't know how I happen to have those along. They're ridiculous." "Well, what do you know how to play?" "Well, no, I taught her to play Russian bank on the humpy, bumpy floor of that mosquito-proof tent, you know. And she beat me, and I didn't think that was very nice. I still hold that against her."
Well, she's a very good teacher.
Well, speaking about teaching,
we're having a great time together.
You're Marty. You're not only coming home to Fairbanks; you're back to your alma mater.
That's right.
Let's see, you were at the University of Alaska when?
1924 was when I graduated.
The University of Alaska was established when?
1923 was Jack Shanley was the first senior. He graduated in 23. I had been to Reed College for 2 years, and to Simmons College in Boston for 1 year, and I had come back home and worked as clerk to the United States Attorney for 1 year, and Judge Bunnell called me one day and said, "We had a board meeting last night, and we decided to start the business administration course," and that was just one thing that I could graduate in, although I was actually an English major, but I said, "All right, I'll be there."
How was it in those early days being, were you the first woman to graduate from the University of Alaska?
Yes.
Did you feel any kind of...
No, it was just great fun. There were about 45 students all together in all the whole school. We were all thrilled to death to be in on the beginnings of things, and Dr. Bunnell had us all excited about the idea of the Farthest North College. Mm-hmm. We started some of the traditions. We started the college magazine, the Farthest North Collegian, the freshman bonfire. We had vaudeville shows and basket socials in the town of Fairbanks in order to raise money for a piano for the school. And I think we felt as though we really owned the place. We were building something, and it was just great, great fun. Yes.
Well, you were also involved in the formulation, the early days, and the evolution of a conservation movement in Alaska.
Yes, that came later, of course. Ole and I were married 2 months after I graduated from college, and it was not until 1946 that he became director of the Wilderness Society. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, he was doing all these other wildlife studies for the Fish and Wildlife. But the conservation aspect of things kept growing and growing. The more he learned about the animals and their habitat, the more concerned he was about the habitat. And one thing led to another, and after Robert Sterling Yard, the first president of the Wilderness Society, died, and one of the council members called Olis. He was already on the first council of the Wilderness Society, but he called and said, "How would you like to be director?" And he said, "No, couldn't possibly. He couldn't live in a city." So 2 days later, they called again and said, "How about taking it half time and half pay and stay in Wyoming?" Well, that was different. So Howard Zonizer took over the Washington office, and Olis and I sort of made a Western headquarters at Moose, and that worked very well, I think. And he and Zonny, as we called him, made a great team. And Shirley Everson was the secretary in the office. Her son, Boyd Everson, is now the new regional director for the National Parks of Alaska. Yeah, I've known some interesting people.
You certainly have.
Well, even today, the tone of debate over environmental issues in Alaska can get fairly strident. What was it like in those days to be involved in some of those issues that were somewhat controversial?
Well, there were some comparatively so few people who were concerned at all, I think, in those days. It took a while for Alaskans to realize that maybe in the midst of this great, big, enormous country, they still might have to consider some responsibilities to the environment itself. And we were dealing with a comparatively very small group of people, you know, Celia and Dinny and Woody and their friends, and Bob Whedon and the rest. I can't think who else. There weren't very many people who were saying anything about Alaska.
Terry Virick were there, and
yes,
and the Melkiers.
Comparatively small numbers of people, but
this was in the early '60s.
Had perception enough to be concerned about what might happen.
How were you regarded? Were you a bunch of lunatics out on the fringe somewhere?
Oh, I don't think people thought about as much at all, did they?
Well, they didn't really worry about as much until we started making a difference. You know, when we started out, we were fairly harmless. But
Well, Celia, tell them about Rampart Dam.
Well, Rampart was one of the early day battles, and that and Project Chariot were the two that took up the time
things.
Of the Alaska Conservation Society in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Project Chariot was the plan by the AEC to blast a harbor, quote-unquote, at Ogotoric Creek south of Point Hope. Because it was a wasteland, and because it would open up all of those vast minerals that were up there, of which nobody could find anything out. But anyway, that was supposed to be it. And Rampart Dam, of course, was the idea of Senator Greening, who thought that this would be a great way. He was going to have the lake. He was going to be a 10 million acre lake that was supposed to be behind Rampart Dam there.
Oh, yes.
It would have taken in all of the Yukon Valley, everything that's
all
in
the
there,
waterfowl habitat.
All the native lands in there, all the wildlife refuge there and everything. But and it would have produced so much electricity that it couldn't possibly have been marketed, and there was no way to get it anywhere. But they were talking about 3 mil power at tidewater. This was going to be the great selling point for that. And of course, they... Ultimately, the thing that defeated Rampart Dam is the same thing that's probably going to defeat the Susitna, and that is that it just is economically infeasible.
Sure.
And that one turned out to be thoroughly so. The Spur Report finally put the kibosh on it.
But you were in bad sport, you know. It wasn't sporting of you to come forth in that debate with whoever it was, with all these facts and figures.
Oh, I know.
Conservationists were supposed to be dreamy sentimentalists, you see. And they complained that Celia, it wasn't fair of her
no.
to have all these facts and figures.
I didn't stick to the birds and the beasts and the moose
right.
and that sort of thing.
Don't confuse us with the facts.
That's right.
And, of course, the thing that finally defeated Project Chariot was the discovery of how absolutely rich the area up there was in terms of both the vegetation, the flora, and the fauna. And that was both sea mammals and the land mammals
yes.
in that area. And that was why Eskimos had been living there from, you know, ancient
thousands
times.
Of years.
And then the second thing that defeated Project Chariot was the discovery that many of the people in northern Alaska were very much contaminated with radioactivity, that the above-ground tests mm-hmm. in the Pacific and in Siberia had fallout.
That's right.
You know, the fallout from it mm-hmm. had landed on the lichens in Alaska.
Studies that the Stenders did with all the...
Yes, and well, then Hanford Radiation Lab came up
yes.
and tested the body count of the Anaktuvik Eskimos and
yes.
discovered that it was way above what the AEC itself considered safe at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that discovery really was serious, and people began to realize that they just couldn't afford to mm-hmm. turn any more radioactivity loose in the atmosphere of Alaska.
The AEC was the
Atomic Energy Commission,
which has since
yes.
been renamed and reorganized. And
yes. It still does the same dastardly things, though.
Yes. Yes, one of the things we need to study about, I
right.
guess. I'm getting pretty tired of the word study.
Mm.
Everything is being studied, and it's in some of these issues, it's time to, for some action to follow.
Well, that's a complaint that's
so
leveled.
We can hope for that.
It's ironic that you, as an environmentalist conservationist, should say that, because so often you'll hear people voice that as a complaint against environmentalists. Well, they just want to study this thing to death. You know, let's get on with it.
Well, there's so much study is just fine, but then there comes a time when something needs to be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all for that, too.
You are in town for an environmental function.
Environmental
You're
assembly,
the
they
speaker.
Call it. Well, one of them, I guess.
What are you going to be speaking about? What is on your mind these days vis-a-vis Alaska and the environment?
Well, I'm talking a little bit about the Fairbanks that I knew, a sort of a little description of how daily life was like in Fairbanks in early days. And then I'm talking about somewhat about 6 or 8 points about the different ways that we need wilderness. And I'm also talking some about people who have influenced the conservation movement by being people who were not only aware, but they were writers who were aware and who began the conservation movement. And then they were followed by writers who were also activists who felt there was something to be done about all these questions. And I'm sticking to sort of generalities in a way mm-hmm. because it's my own feelings about the whole subject. And the issues themselves will have been discussed by these various people represented on panels during the assembly.
Well, I think many of our listeners would be interested in your remarks on the generalities. And by the time this program airs, the conference will have been over, so people won't have the opportunity to, if they missed your remarks, to hear them. So, unless, of course, you share them with us right now. I would love to hear you talk a little bit about the Fairbanks that you remember and the Fairbanks that you've come home to now and
well, I was,
how,
I was
how
just,
you feel about it. Just give us a little taste of
what
you're going
to be talking
about.
The first thing that happened when my family moved to Fairbanks when I was 9 years old was the gift to me of a well-trained Malamute dog named Major. And Major and I, with my little coaster sled, went all over, ran all the errands for Mother, ran all over town. There was hardly any traffic to bother us, just other kids with their dog sleds, maybe, and other dog teams. And I think I'm emphasizing the point that, that children in that time growing up here grew up in an atmosphere of tolerance and love, partly because they were important, because they were comparatively few. So much of the population was unattached men who were up here gold-seeking or trapping for fur. I'm trying to give sort of a picture of what daily life in Fairbanks was like in those days. And I remember that these old-timers, some of them who were mining in the summer, came in to spend winters in Fairbanks, and they'd be around the town. And you'd meet them, and they'd untangle the dog harness for you and tell you a story about a dog and maybe push a 50-cent piece into your hand, say, here, go buy yourself some candy. And the skating rink was just downriver, down below the Cushman Street Bridge, and there were always some old sourdoughs there keeping a fire going so we could warm ourselves and watching us and say, hey, you, your nose is white, go rub some snow on it. This is the kind of thing that I remember from my growing up in Fairbanks, and it maybe is an aspect that I don't know whether it's all lost, but at least it's a part of history. But there's a great deal of a rich and rewarding life to still be to be lived up here still, I think.
Do you think it's possible for us to in some way preserve that spirit or maybe recapture some of what we've lost?
Yes.
Can it really be that way today?
I think it may be rather important for people to know a little bit about the early life in Fairbanks, because there were the, you might say, spiritual aspects of it that are worth thinking about and doing something about and preserving. And I don't see why Fairbanks can't be a community where people care for one another. Mm-hmm. And I hope it still is. And I think I'll be going back to Wyoming feeling very hopeful about it all.
I think there is a good spirit.
Yes,
in a lot
I've heard
of
that from a good
Fairbanks.
Many sources. And I think one of the important things about that is that people are learning to work for various causes that they feel are important. I don't care whether it's wilderness or native rights or whatever, mm-hmm. but there is a particular kind of joy in working together with a group of people and remembering it also to have some fun while you're doing it.
It is easy. You know, I've only been here a very short time. I think I first came to Fairbanks maybe 10 years ago. But even in the short time that I've been here, I have felt, well, there have been so many changes. And, gee, it's not like it used to be. And I know that a lot of people are feeling that way these days. But as you say, there's still an opportunity here for us to shape our own community.
They need to stop and think about that and take pride in the fact of the situation in which they're living. It's an unusual part of the world. It's a very rich part of the world as far as experience goes. And people need to learn to be grateful for that, I think.
Mm-hmm. What do you see right now as the as the state of environmental issues in Alaska? What are the really pressing issues in your mind, and how do you feel about the way that they're being addressed?
Well, I think one of the pressing needs right now is for instance, for the National Park Service to have a great deal of courage. I think there's certain consideration for the habitat of places like Gates of the Arctic, for instance, that need to be seriously considered. I don't think that airplanes should be allowed to land on every lake in the Brooks Range. I think there's a lot of things about subsistence that need to be looked at and scrutinized, and it's too bad to have to think that you have this great big wilderness, but you still have to have regulations enforced against man himself, because man is such a restless creature and is not always wise in how he treats the planet. I don't know as much about the Bureau of Land Management and the National Forest Service. The National Forests are under scrutiny all over the country right now, and the Wilderness Society and some of the other conservation groups are making a real citizen study of how our national forests are managed. And certainly we have a crew at work down in the Tongass right now. Those are things that are going on and that need to go on, I think. And again, it comes back, I think, to the government agencies being a little more careful in how they proceed and being more courageous in the things that they need to enforce. I think those are really some of... You probably know of a lot more issues, Celia. I don't pretend to know all the details of what goes on up here.
Well, what about it, Celia? Let me ask you the same question.
I think that Marty's touched on some of the most important ones. I think it's a matter of really implanting the concept of stewardship.
Yes.
On the part of not merely people who go into, who have to do with conservation units, but everywhere that we have anything to do with land, that we treat it gently, that we understand what we're doing, that we care about it, and that we try to keep in mind the rights of the creatures that live here, who have a right to habitat and a right to a place to live as much as we do. And I think if we... It's a land ethic, really, that we need to have, and it needs to start with each individual, and to proceed from that individual into larger government organizations. Because the thing that's happened is that the Reagan administration has not observed much of an ethic in terms of the environment. They seem to feel that business can proceed, you know, that you can have business prosperity without having a healthy land base underneath it. And I just don't believe that, and I don't think there are very many people who really believe that today. So those are the things that I see.
You use that term, land ethic, which I guess goes back to Aldo Leopold and Sand County.
In a way, but when Celia was director of the Wilderness Society, getting us through a very difficult transition period, I think that's when we first began talking about land ethic as a phrase that we were going to be using more and more in the society's
work. That's
right. Is that ethic taking hold in American society?
Yes, I think so. You hear more and more about it. I was on a radio show with Gaylord Nelson of the Wilderness Society in Asheville, North Carolina in October, when the Wilderness Society celebrating its 50th anniversary there in the Great Smoky Mountains, where it all began, with five men sitting by the roadside arguing about some conference they'd just been attending and deciding that some organization needed to come forth that had wilderness in view. And the young reporter asked Gaylord, Gaylord Nelson has been called the father of Earth Day 1970, uh-huh. And that's when he was a senator from Wisconsin, I guess. He said, "How do you feel about it now?" And Gaylord said, "I think the important thing now is that I see that the people themselves in their own little communities everywhere are waking up and beginning to take some responsibility for what happens in their own environment." And he felt that was the most important outcome of Earth Day.
It's not just the Sierra Club or the Wilderness
Society
or some big national
organization. You can't depend on big government or big business or even big conservation organizations to do the whole thing. That's why I think it's so remarkable that out of what were there maybe two such organizations 10 years ago, Celia?
Mm-hmm.
Now there are 40.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
In Alaska.
In Alaska.
40 conservation organizations are growing.
Well, and I think another evidence of it is right here in Fairbanks. I just got a communication in the mail from the Goldstream Valley Residents Organization.
Well.
And they are very much concerned about the possibility of having a refinery located in the Fox area because of the air pollution that might be involved in it and that sort of thing. Those are citizens who are not necessarily environmentalists at all. They're just worried about their own backyard. And another one is the group of citizens who have banded together to try to save the Skyline Ridge area. And those people have not started from a greenie base whatsoever. They are just landowners and users and people around the area who are concerned. So
stopping and taking a look.
I think that there's just a lot of evidence these days of people really buckling down and deciding, well, you know, they've stopped looking for the they. And, you know, we've always in the past, we thought they would save
they
us.
They should. Why don't they?
Why don't they do something and are looking around and saying, hey, it's up to us.
They is us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have met the enemy and he is us.
So, Celia, you've been involved with national conservation organizations, the Wilderness Society. You were executive director. But you've also been involved for years with grassroots Alaskan organizations. You're part of the Alaskan Conservation Foundation.
Right.
Still on the board of directors there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Alaska Conservation Society. And you're involved with the Alaska Environmental Assembly and a number of other organizations. What do you see now as the state of those organizations? How is their image? How is their effectiveness? Are they healthy and vigorous? Are they out of fashion?
I don't think they're out of fashion at all. I think it's been amazing in the last 5 or 6 years to see the proliferation of memberships in all of these various organizations. I think one of the most heartening things is the coordination that has been created through the Alaska Environmental Assembly, which is the umbrella organization that involves all of these 40 or more local organizations and local centers. And the other two things, the other two statewide organizations that are, well, there's three of them actually. One of them is the Alaska Environmental Lobby, which is highly respected in Juneau. They had a reception last year in their little tiny office. They're operating on a shoestring, of course, like most environmental groups. And they had a reception, and it was so packed that nobody could move because everybody in the legislature was coming around to see people at the lobby.
Yes.
And another organization that's statewide is the Alaska Environmental Political Action Committee, which has been putting money into political campaigns of people who are supportive of environmental concerns. Then the third one is the Alaska Conservation Foundation, which we, Denny Wilcher and a group of us, started in 1980, and which has been operating now for I've just completed 2 3-year terms and as chairman of the board, and we have raised several $100,000, which has gone into these organizations here in the state. And the support that these organizations are getting is really very widespread, and I think they are being noticed. There is more. For a while, you know, there was a tendency to look down on everything environmental or always just beginners and that sort of thing, but I think the positive aspects of environmental protection are coming to the fore more now.
Huh. Yes, and time, too.
Yes.
Well, Marty, as you drive down Airport Road during your stay here in Fairbanks, I have to ask you, what was Airport Road when you came to Fairbanks?
It wasn't.
It was an expanse of little sloughs, little ponds where there were ducks in the spring, and a muskeg tundra and birch groves clear to the river. Yeah, it was just empty country that we kids wandered around in, you know, caught tadpoles and picked wild iris and
watched
the snipes.
When Jenny and I arrived at Fairbanks on January 1st, 1947, the edge of town was Weeks Field.
Yes.
Ninth Avenue was the edge of town, and beyond that there was nothing.
8th and Bonnefield when we came here in 1911.
How many people were here in 1911?
Oh, Fairbanks was quite a booming. It was about 5,000. it was in the midst of the gold.
It's about 5,000 when we arrived here in 1947.
Yes, and then it didn't grow much for quite a while.
My goodness.
Yes. But that's it. We still like.
You can compare that to 75,000 in the borough, which I just noted was
yes,
the final figure.
Yes, I just read that this morning, too. Well, let's hope in the 75,000 there's still enough people who care.
I think there are.
That's all we can hope for.
Well, I think we've just about run out of time. Is there anything else you want to add on your homecoming, Marty?
Just my general impression of wonderful, friendly people, and I just hope you all keep on caring for one another. I'm very grateful to be here for a visit.
Well, it's a delight to have you back.
Thank
I'm sure you've
sir.
Got a lot of friends that you want to see in the next few days.
Yes.
A few days, few hours. You're here very shortly.
Yes. I'm going down to Anchorage in a couple of days.
Hmm. Well,
lots of people there, too.
Yes.
Welcome back, and thank you so much, both of you, for visiting with us. I hope that you've enjoyed it half as much as I have.
I have, really.
It's been a pleasure.
Our guests on Home Fires this morning have been Margaret Murray and Celia Hunter. I'm John Adams, sitting in for Patty Kostelic, who will be back next week. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella. Thanks very much for listening.